Your Health is supported by the North Carolina Cancer Hospital, serving you with innovative research with unequaled care. UNC Healthcare is leading, teaching, caring.
News Talk 1360, WCHL, and UNC Family Medicine present Your Health with Dr. Adam Goldstein and Dr. Christy Page. Your Health, providing practical health-related news and information for our listeners. Dr. Goldstein and Dr. Page are both actively involved in patient care at UNC Family Medicine. Now, Your Health.
Welcome to UNC Family Medicine's Your Health, supported by UNC Healthcare. I'm Dr. Adam Goldstein.
And I'm Dr. Christy Page.
And on our show today, we're going to be talking with Dr. Linda Van Lee about women and cancer, the third in our series on the new faces of cancer. Christy?
Yeah, I'm looking forward to that conversation. But first, Adam, we've got some information about food allergies and hearing loss and some real research that matters. Let's jump into it.
Yeah, you might think that what we're going to talk about today is maybe alternative, but I think it's mainstream. It's just things people have never heard of, like how many people look at their food labels when they go buy food products. If they're allergic to peanuts and they see a label that says this product may contain trace elements of peanuts, do you need to worry about that?
Yeah, this is an interesting article that is really relevant to the 2% of adults who have food allergies and 4 to 8% of kids who have food allergies. So if you're a parent and with a child with allergies, then sure, you may be paying attention to these. And the question is, does it matter?
Yeah, this was actually an article in the Journal of Allergy and Clinical Immunology, and the authors in Mount Sinai School of Medicine looked at 401 foods from the supermarket. And 228 had labels saying that these products that were on the supermarket shelves could be contaminated with peanuts, milk, or eggs. And they also looked at other products that did not have those types of labels and then saw to what extent did these products actually have those ingredients so that it could theoretically be dangerous to people.
And what they found were about 5% of the foods that had those warning labels saying they could be contaminated did have traces of allergens compared with 2% of the foods who didn't have any labels. And the most common contamination was peanuts. It was really unclear the levels that were in there, whether those were clinically significant, meaning whether or not a child or an adult exposed to that trace amount would actually have a reaction. But they did find the traces in about 5% of the ones with the warning labels.
Yeah, this was actually very important for me, Christy, because I frequently see these labels and I think, it probably isn't all that important. And now all of a sudden I'm looking at this, I'm going, well, actually, it really could be important, particularly because I've seen some really severe peanut allergies over time. I'm sure you have.
Sure.
As well. And for those people, even, sometimes even if they're next to someone who's eating peanuts and kind of the dust from the peanuts that, they can really break out.
That can be scary.
And so it's clear to me that patients need to look at these labels and probably avoid these foods if they have this sort of label. The question is, what if they don't have this label?
Right. And you can't be 100% certain if it doesn't have a label that it wouldn't have some contamination. So they did find that it was more common that products that were from smaller companies were about 7 times more likely to have some contamination with allergens than ones from bigger companies, presumably because they had more resources to clean the machines or use different machines and that sort of thing.
And I wonder if places that have organic produce, organic things, maybe less or not. They didn't look into this, but it'd be something I would want to be looking at if I were, in the future, I am purchasing these products. What do we have next?
All right. This is concerning to me, and certainly you as a parent of teenagers, hearing loss on the increase among U.S. teenagers. What do you think about
this?
Yeah,
this was an article in the Journal of the American Medical Association, and it's kind of striking because I do know that growing up, I had some hearing loss growing up from loud concerts, but being right, it wasn't the iPods at the time, but it was being in those concert halls and being right next to those speakers, all of that, and then playing the music in your stereo system in the cars. And they looked at the likelihood that you had hearing loss among teenagers a decade ago and then looked at now, where you would think maybe it's less now because we're better treating ear infections and more aware of these kinds of problems.
Yeah, and it was pretty astounding to find out that comparing the data from the early 1990s to the mid-2000s, that really hearing loss has been on the increase. So about 15% of teenagers had some degree of hearing loss back in the early 90s. And then 15 years later, that number had risen by a third to nearly 20%. 20%. And, you know, it's unclear what all the factors are that could be leading to this. But my assumption, as is yours, Adam, it sounds like, is that the iPods and the MP3 players and all of the technology that we have at our fingertips may be playing a role.
Yeah, you know, I call this the airplane effect. You know, when you're riding on that airplane and the person next to you has those earplugs in and the music's so loud that you can follow everything for the two-hour ride, and you know that there's just this constant exposure. Mm-hmm. And it appears to me that this is a question not just for parents, what there is something here for parents to say to their children, but also for manufacturers of products, that there has to be a safe level at which they cannot go above with their product. And I don't know that there is one.
I don't know that there is, certainly not in the most commonly used MP3 players and iPods and those things, but I think there should be. And I think it's our duty as consumers and as healthcare professionals to advocate for that type of thing because it matters. It matters if you have hearing loss. You don't do as well in school. It's harder to develop appropriately. So,
and if you have a teenager, our encouragement will be to make sure they do get a hearing test every year now because it's clear that one out of five, the next five that come in, one of them will probably have some hearing loss, and that may be playing into how they do in school, which may then ultimately play in how they do in jobs.
Well, the next study is about fibromyalgia and a new way to potentially treat and alleviate pain.
Yeah, we're talking about Tai Chi, not tea, but Tai Chi, that oriental form of meditation and yoga and movement, this combined physical, emotional, spiritual way of approaching healing.
So this was a study that was done at Tufts Medical Center and published in the New England Journal of Medicine. And they looked at 66 patients who had fibromyalgia and followed them over time, over 12 weeks. Had one group who did Tai Chi, which is this ancient Chinese practice, over time, and another group who were prescribed stretching exercises and wellness education.
Yeah, and those that they got the twice weekly Tai Chi and the DVD to practice showed improvement on measures that are really meaningful to patients. On fibromyalgia, the type of pain that they would have and the way they would sleep and their ability to get out and exercise. And even a third of them stopped using medication compared to significantly less who were able to stop doing this in the stretching group.
And I mean, it makes some sense to me that something very calming and something that is multifaceted in that it affects your body and your mind, and there's a spiritual component to this, perhaps, that it's more than just here's a pill to make it go away. Because we know that fibromyalgia is a very complex pain condition, and it makes sense that something more complex, in a sense, like Tai Chi, although it's also very simple.
Well, this raises more questions than answers, frankly, for me, though, because I think it's interesting. We see so many people with fibromyalgia. It's such a difficult process, and the treatments we have aren't great, and this may be a really good treatment. On the other hand, this is a small number of people. This was done in a controlled setting. What happens when people have to pay for the Tai Chi, which they didn't have to pay for it in this setting? What if it's not done the same way this person did? What about the placebo effect of positive suggestion? All of these things suggest to me that you're not likely to have the same results in the real world as they had in this particular study, but I still think we need more research on this topic.
Well, and fibromyalgia is one of those things that so many people discount, and so I'm glad that we found something to make some headway.
Well, something that can really make headway that I think we can all agree on is our last research that matters. It's about cancer patients who live longer with palliative care. Another article is in the New England Journal of Medicine.
So palliative care is when we use a team of doctors, nurses, social workers, and chaplains to help people and their family cope with pain and also think about emotional and spiritual parts of a diagnosis. And in this study, they look to see if that makes a difference for people in their longevity and also in their quality of life.
And for people with advanced lung cancer. And they did. They lived 2 months longer and they had this palliative care. And the real question is, does this translate to other chronic diseases and other cancers? And again, this was provided free. Do all hospitals have it? The cost involved? Lots of questions, but really suggestive that this multidisciplinary team approach to care that we can talk with Dr. Van Lee about in just a few minutes here at UNC Healthcare has an impact. So that probably concludes what we can talk about today,
it
Christy.
It does. We've talked a little bit about food allergies and about hearing loss in teenagers.
Look at your labels. Turn down those iPods.
We've talked about fibromyalgia and potentially a new approach.
Considering Tai Chi and meditation.
And about palliative care and the benefits both for living longer and for quality of life.
Well, that'll conclude the Research That Matters. We'll take a short break, and when we return, we'll be talking with Dr. Linda Van Lee about women and cancer. You're listening to UNC Family Medicine's Your Health with Dr. Adam Goldstein and Dr. Christy Page.
Your Health with Dr. Adam Goldstein and Dr. Christy Page on News Talk 1360 WCHL, sponsored by UNC Family Medicine. And now, more of Your Health.
Welcome back to UNC Family Medicine's Your Health with Dr. Adam Goldstein and Dr. Christy Page. Today on Conversations, we'll be talking about women and cancer. And we've had a chance in the past to talk a bit about breast cancer and a little bit about ovarian cancer. And today we're really pleased to have a conversation about women and cancer with respect to the new cancer hospital at UNC, and to think about the real experience that is unique to women who suffer from cancer.
And we'd like to welcome Dr. Linda Van Lee to Your Health. Dr. Van Lee is a professor and acting division director for the Division of Gynecologic Oncology at UNC Lineberger Comprehensive Cancer Center. Dr. Van Lee completed medical school and residency training in obstetrics and gynecology at the University of California, San Francisco, followed by a fellowship in gynecologic oncology at UNC Chapel Hill. And I've known Dr. Van Lee probably ever since I came here because I'm remembering one of my first patients who had metastatic ovarian cancer 20 years ago who I think is still doing well. So welcome to the show.
Thank you very much.
You know, Dr. Van Lee, we love to talk with our guests about their personal story, about the things that led you to become a physician and in your case, to really focus on women and cancer. And I was reading an article about you. I hear you're sort of a child prodigy, huh?
Oh, that seems like a long time ago. You do what you have to do.
Well, tell us what led you to medical school and to your field.
You know, a lot of physicians who become gynecologic oncologists really have to have a passion for it. It's a 24/7 job for just about your entire adult life, as well as fellowship and residency. And a lot of us really find the passion for it, actually, as medical students. And that's what happened to me. I was rotating on OBGYN. We had a GYN oncology rotation. And it just seemed so meaningful to be able to help people. And I know that's kind of a general term, but really you can help a lot of our patients at many levels, whether it be surgically, chemotherapy, emotional support, or just connecting and giving them some hope or some guidance. So I think this field actually offers all of it. And for the most part, all of my colleagues are very satisfied with their professional life and how they've been able to help people.
Well, I know we're going to want to touch on a lot of those things that you just mentioned, but I wonder if you could actually just give us an example of what is a typical day for you yesterday or today or tomorrow? What's that typical day, that 24/7 look like and the wide scope of different things that you do?
Sure. Well, for example, today, before I met with you, I was operating. And starts at 7 in the morning, you're coming in, usually would like to greet the patient ahead of time, just review what you're going to do, then you do your surgery, and, you know, certainly surgery is your craft, and you feel at the end of the surgery, hopefully you've done the best you can, given a large collection of what you think is right, what your surgical skills allow you to do, taking in what you understand the prognosis is. And I think really important is that at the end of surgery, you feel you've done a good job and that the patient has had few complications or has had the best outcome.
And you had was it a surgical case that you had to do this morning?
A couple. I did a couple. And going out and talking with the family is actually a big thing. And it almost seems like something you have to do. It's part of your regular chore or whatever, but it's really very satisfying to come out and tell your family, look, we did the best we could. She unfortunately has cancer. That's a sad thing, but we did A, B, and C, and this is the next step, and it's really important just to support her day by day because the postoperative period is so important to just get through that and kind of guide them to what's important immediately because it can be very frazzling and anxiety-provoking. People are asking, oh, well, are they going to die already? Well, you know, obviously, post-op, that's a really hard thing to say, and we're not going to talk about that yet. So in the daily life on a surgical day, that's what we do. And it's punctuated by these little interactions with family that really are so meaningful to us, everyone.
And then, we want to hear more about the other activities that you're involved in. But thinking about these families and the patient, do you, after you've had those conversations, which sounds like you're very committed to, and that I commend you for that, so important, then do you have a chance in their post-op follow-up to sit down again with the family? And I would imagine they've got their whole list of questions or things that they couldn't process when you first talk with them.
Always. They always. And I think post-op day one, people are a little more awake. The patient's awake. usually don't talk to them much on the day of surgery. I had once a patient, I think 8 hours post-op, she had 22 family members in her room. And she introduced every family member to me. And I was just amazed. And I thought, you know, this lady's pretty awake, right? She remembered everyone. Well, lo and behold, post-op day one, 24 hours later, she didn't remember a thing.
Wow.
She didn't remember 22 members. She didn't remember our conversation. And that really drove home. The first day after surgery, waiting the 24 hours is really worthwhile.
Right.
Well, how is, you know, you deal with female gynecologic cancers, and certainly we know breast cancer, ovarian cancer, endometrial cancer, cervical cancer, these, you know, major cancers. How has the whole field of cancer care for women changed since you started taking care of patients, what seems like yesterday?
Well, you know, they're all a little bit different and different cell types. I think the cancer that has caused most drama in almost everyone's life is ovarian cancer. It's certainly rare, but I often describe it as lethal because it presents so at such an advanced stage. So, in regards to ovarian cancer, you know, our specialty keeps working on a screening protocol. We're not there yet. We keep trying to look at various permutations of CA125, ultrasound, and it's just a hard place to be. So I think, at least for all of us physicians who are taking care of patients and the patients, I think we're actually making more headway with treatment.
And what about endometrial cancer? Because that's still, I think, one that we don't talk about that much. I don't know why, but we don't. And I just had a patient today who's in the hospital for endometrial cancer.
Yeah, so endometrial is the most common GYN cancer, and luckily the prognosis is often good. In other words, a surgery, having your uterus out, you know, selecting some nodes to see if there are bad prognostic factors or things that are worrisome about that particular cancer case is usually all a patient needs. In fact, 3/4 of the time, the uterus, the endometrial cancer is early stage, stage one. But I think something that we almost take for granted now, but we really need to let everyone know, is the surgery for this is so different. And UNC, I'm proud to say, is one of the major centers for robotic surgery. And that is a surgery where, again, using these tiny, tiny incisions, we can do a kind of more extensive surgery because the technique and technology is better. The rotation of the robot ports and arms give us more flexibility, and we can do surgery more quickly, almost more accurately, and on heavier patients, and they go home the next day.
That is fantastic.
And I'll just make a plug. You know, UNC is probably one of the number one robotic centers in the country. We have fabulous robotic surgeons here.
That is great. The other thing, thinking about things that may have changed in advancing, is about chemotherapy. I understand you're the director of the Women's Hospital Chemotherapy Clinic, so I guess you're the right person to ask about what changes we've found or what women may experience now with chemotherapy that could be different than perhaps 20 years ago.
You know, I think the stereotype when, and all the patients feel this, when they hear chemotherapy, just alarm goes off. And I think they picture what I pictured and what I saw when I was a student is that having chemotherapy was debilitating. There was a lot of nausea and vomiting and malaise and just feeling crummy. And people would just go hide out in their rooms. Well, that is no longer the case. We have chemotherapy that can be given outpatient. We have great supportive care meds so that people don't have to be sick. I think we're trying to head back to where they can have good quality of life and resume their daily activities.
And what about the fear? Is that continues to be a major factor that deals with people with chemotherapy?
You know, I've been doing this a long time, and I have probably several times a year I have a patient who says, and who could really be helped by chemotherapy, says, I'm just not going to do it. I'm just not going to do it. And I usually say, try it once. You know, I'm not going to twist your arm, but you would be surprised at how well you do. And I think out of my, 20 years of doing this, 17 actually, I've had one patient not take the chemotherapy. And everyone has had extended life and really has done well. So I usually say, give it a try.
Well, Dr. VanLee, I know we're going to need to take a short break, but when we come back, I really hope we'll be able to talk a little bit more about that, the experience that is unique to women with cancer and all the different roles that a woman might have and how that plays out in these family dynamics that you are talking about. We are talking with Dr. Linda VanLee of the UNC Lineberger Comprehensive Cancer Center in the Division of Gynecologic Oncology. And we'll be right back after a break with UNC Family Medicine's Your Health with Dr. Adam Goldstein and Dr. Christy Page. Stay with us. Your Health is supported by UNC Health Sciences Library and NC Health Info, working together to connect people everywhere with knowledge to improve health. Visit nchealthinfo.org for answers you can trust.
Your Health with Dr. Adam Goldstein and Dr. Christy Page on WCHL. And now, back to the show.
Welcome back. You're listening to UNC Family Medicine's Your Health with Dr. Adam Goldstein and Dr. Christy Page. And we've been talking with Dr. Linda VanLee of the Division of Gynecologic Oncology at UNC Lineberger Comprehensive Cancer Center about women with cancer. And Dr. VanLee, right before we broke, we were talking a little bit about the chemotherapy and overcoming some of the fear. And I know we're going to talk about in a little while what the whole new cancer hospital at UNC and all of the work that's going into research to try to change that whole experience of cancer. But I think we wanted just to focus in a little bit more on the experience for women who have cancer and the changes that are somewhat unique. For instance, with a lot of the work you do, I'm sure loss of organs and loss of the uterus and ovaries has to have an impact that's unique to women.
Yeah, and you know, it's funny that you ask that because from my chair and my seat, I've only taken care of women. So it is very unique, of course, to just women. And I think while it does impact them, women are so capable. And really, almost all women I've met, which is why it's such a joy to take care of women, have such a broad view of what their life is about. And a lot of them, I'd say maybe a minority of them, are really fixated on not having those. But I have to say that most women say, okay, I had to have it out, but let's keep going and let's keep trucking. And that's the majority of the attitude that we see with for our patients who have had ovarian cancer.
And what about, I mean, I've had some of my patients, one in particular I'm thinking of, were right after her first child had a diagnosis, and in this case it was breast cancer, and underwent chemotherapy and had to, had a really very scary experience and is a survivor to this day. But it changed things with her family planning, thinking about being a new mom and wanting to live for her family. And I wonder if you I'm sure with more of a comprehensive team approach, the way that you do at the Lineberger Cancer Center, that you're involved in some of these conversations about what it's like perhaps to be a mother with young children and have a diagnosis of cancer.
Well, this is really where being a mother kicks in. First of all, we are kind of glad that ovarian cancer in young women is rare. It's like less than 5%. So fortunate or unfortunate, the majority of patients are postmenopausal. But for the young women, it's a really emotional experience. Certainly, they're worried about their family. And a lot of times they don't say a lot, but you can see these are really determined women because mm-hmm. not only is it for themselves, but their entire family. And these are patients who are in this situation really... They're hard fighters. They will go to the end, extra lab draws, clinical trials, whatever it takes. And, you know, it really embodies all of motherhood.
And you're also talking about if for gynecologic cancers, if you're taking out a ovary or uterus, a surgical menopause in cases. And that brings into play postmenopausal issues. How do you approach that in terms of the way that women, for instance, taking hormone replacement, which would be probably contraindicated in some, how do you have that conversation?
We know luckily in 2010 we have a lot of alternatives similar to the breast folks. There are some women in our group who really are concerned about taking the hormones. So we have things to other agents to address all of those menopausal changes. But I think it's really important, and especially as a woman taking care of women with GYN cancer, to ask those questions. And I ask these routinely. How is your personal life? How's your skin feeling? Are you uncomfortable in any of the areas that are affected by menopausal change? And I think really, again, I think the men actually do participate in that, too. We're very women-oriented. But as a woman, I actually make a huge effort to just say, how's that part going?
Well, and to really have an open conversation about one's sexual health, I would imagine you're having some of those conversations before and after surgery or a treatment plan, because that's such an important part of all of our lives.
Absolutely. And it's also important just to start acting normal, you know, getting back to your daily activities, whatever that routine mm-hmm. is as part of that. So trying to regain your normal self.
I mean, I know taking care of a lot of men with prostate cancer that it, unfortunately, a side effect of most of the treatment still is impotence. But the men that I deal with talk about how the fear of I guess, not having cancer is so much better that they don't really worry about it. But yet we still have to have conversations about it because sexuality is still important in their relationship. How do you have those conversations about sexual health with a woman and her partner?
Yeah, so I usually start by talking to a woman individually, and I'll start by teasing her, and she'll say, oh, you know, we're afraid, or you know, I just don't have someone. And we kind of just make it into a woman-to-woman girl thing. And I'll just try and tease them into it or just ask, is there anything I can do, and explore that part a little bit. Although mm-hmm. I will say pre-op, I may not have had all the time to explore what their situation was from the get-go, but trying to encourage them to not be fearful and start just getting back into their regular life.
Right. And I guess, and you bring up a really good point of finding out what is their regular life and what was that original function and what are their treatment goals or what are their goals for their quality of life moving forward. And so I guess after you have that woman-to-woman conversation, then you can bring the partner in if that's appropriate.
Absolutely. And a lot of our patients have partners who are very supportive. I feel we're very lucky in our cancer center.
And what, speaking of the cancer center, we have this large new cancer center at UNC Healthcare, and how has the field of cancer care changing in a facility like that to enable the types of research that needs to be done and the care that needs to be given over the next decade?
So our cancer hospital is the monument to clinical care, essentially. I think it's a testimony to saying we really respect and want to take good care of our patients in that everything is updated, chemo suite is different, the pharmacy system is more efficient, mammogram is more efficient. And to that end, clinically, I think that the volume that it can accommodate, more beds, I think the more relaxed and kind of collegial feeling because it's not so cramped as the old situation was. And in regards to clinical trials, there have been provisions made for a clinical trials unit, just a lot of the resources that we need to function better, whether it be for clinical trials or as an accompaniment to basic research.
What will a patient see? What would be one of the first things a patient would see different coming in for care in this new system compared to, what, say, 10 years ago?
Well, I think this cancer hospital is particularly beautiful. So when you walk in the foyer, you see just relaxed peacefulness. And again, kind of when a patient comes in, they're feeling kind of crummy and they see this place. It's really, again, kind of a message back to them that we recognize that they're going through a lot and let's try and make it nice for them, treat them well, nice chairs. That's what I see about the cancer hospital, and I think that's what makes it really special.
Well, aren't you one of those lovely pictures that's right up right when you walk in?
I feel honored that I got to have a picture up there. It was great.
It's a great picture.
You look like you're about 22 there.
I do appreciate
and,
it.
It's beautiful.
Well, let me ask you one last question because we'll be having to wrap up in a second. But tell us a little bit before you leave about the field of research here. What are some of the pressing things that either you're involved in or that some of your colleagues are involved in that people should know about?
We have a lot of good research going on and at all levels. I'll just talk about mine briefly in that because we're a pretty established clinical division, we have a lot of volume, we have a lot of experienced GYN oncologists. There are 8 of us, which is a good number. We are able to do really important clinical trials. For example, we're the only site in North Carolina for a clinical trial with a new targeted agent, and I think for regular people we call a form of chemotherapy. That is really promising, and I think when this one finishes and we'll wait for the results, I think because we are who we are, we have such great support, we're able to bring these clinical trials to UNC and take good care of people and offer them the newest and the greatest. In addition to that, we have background kind of basic science work that's really important. One of my colleagues is specializing in endometrial cancers, again, working with pharma and trying to find a way to treat those few patients who have advanced disease. We have, again, I mentioned the robotic area, so exploring new and improved surgical approaches. So in one way, in several ways, we're very lucky. We have several aspects of really exciting research.
Well, and it's great to feel, it sounds like I can hear how proud you feel of it, and we feel so proud of it too. It's really, really neat to be part of an institution where we can feel so proud of what we're doing in the area of cancer care. So we really can't thank you enough for the care that you're providing to our patients and just for taking
and
time
to talk
to us today.
And the care that you have provided for two decades to my patients as well.
That's right.
Thank you so much
for being with us.
Thank you for inviting me.
We've been talking with Dr. Linda Van Lee of the UNC Lineberger Comprehensive Cancer Center. Coming up on House Calls, we'll be answering questions about your health. You're listening to UNC Family Medicine's Your Health with Dr. Adam Goldstein and Dr. Christy Page. Stay with us.
Your Health with Dr. Adam Goldstein and Dr. Christy Page on News Talk 1360 WCHL, sponsored by UNC Family Medicine. And now, more of Your Health.
Welcome back to UNC Family Medicine's Your Health. For House Call segment of our show today, we're going to talk about your questions and experiences and attitudes.
And we want you to write us about your experiences and questions and send them to yourhealth@unc.edu, or you can call us at 919-966-8081. So now we'll have our producer, Julie Steiner, read some of the questions we have today. Julie?
Our first listener says, I have a friend who's on medication, which is extended release. She constantly cuts the medication in half, taking only one half tablet a day so that it will last longer. I read once that this was a very bad idea with extended release medications. Who is right?
Well, I don't know if Christy and I like to take sides here on the show, but what would you say, Christy? I would say that you shouldn't be cutting them in general if it's extended release. What do you say?
Right. Well, I'd say you should, first of all, always talk with your doctor about what you're actually taking versus what the doctor is prescribing, because y'all could work that out, perhaps. And cutting the tablets is only acceptable when the medication is scored or when it has one of those lines down the middle of it, because that way you know the medicine's been dispersed evenly across the pill. So if it doesn't have a line down the middle, then cutting it is not a good
idea. Typically, extended release just means over 12 hours or over 24 hours. It doesn't mean that you can take it and it extends the effect over 2 days.
Right,
and so
right.
You really, no matter what you're looking at, you're getting less of the medicine, which, whether it's extended release or not, that's probably not what the doctor prescribed or ordered.
Right. So talk with the doctor and be careful about cutting if it doesn't have a line.
And particularly if it's a capsule, don't do it.
Yes. Okay. Julie, what do we have next?
I'm surprised I haven't heard more about the flu shot this summer. When can we get it? Will we need separate shots for swine flu again this year?
Great question. You know, I think Christy and I had this same conversation a couple of weeks ago. I was kind of surprised, too, that, you know, last year at this time, summer, all summer long, into the summer, swine flu was still all around us, and barely have you heard a blip out of it.
I know. Hardly any comments. So I would say that I'm grateful that they were able to combine the H1N1 protection into this year's flu shot. So you shouldn't have to get a separate shot, according to the CDC and their website.
You'll get it at the same time with that single shot. And right now it's recommended that you get it like you normally would when you get the flu shot, which for most people is sometime in October. That's usually when most people in clinics, including family medicine, will start having the flu shot.
So it's recommended everyone 6 months of age or older get a flu shot. And supposedly they've been shipping from the manufacturers, but we don't yet have them. So keep in touch with your doctor's office to find out.
I would say call us October 1st and call your own providers October 1st, because right now there's really no reason to get it earlier than that.
Sure. Okay,
what
Julie?
Do we have next?
My son fell at Target and hurt his arm. He screamed in a way that I knew he was truly hurting, and he wouldn't move his arm at all. It was the weekend, and the UNC ER was the only option. During the x-ray, the tech had to twist his arm, and when he did, suddenly my son was fine. It turns out he had what's called a nursemaid's elbow, and now he's fine. I sure wish I had known this before paying for an ER visit and x-rays, but at least we only had to wait for 2 hours.
Well, I think a lot of us wish we had known something after we went to see the doctor or after you went to the dentist, but that's just not the way it works sometimes.
Although it sounds good if you're in and out in 2 hours.
Yeah, I mean, that's right. So far, so good. And you got your...
He's better.
You got your child's better. I mean, that's a win-win-win.
It sure is. It sounds like... I mean, sometimes we don't need to do x-rays for something that's called nursemaid's elbow or...
Why is it called nursemaid's elbow, Christy?
Because it typically happens when someone is swinging a child or if you're pulling him against his will. And so I think the thought was
that. Or the child's running in front of the car and you jerk
him
that
back.
Child back. And it's not child abuse. It's maybe saving the child's life.
Right, exactly. The fancy word for it is radial head subluxation. But usually x-rays aren't indicated if it's straightforward. But in this case, if your child fell down, that's normally not the way. I mean, unless you were pulling him back up, it's normally not the way that it happens. So anyway, glad that he's better.
And there could also be a small fracture there as well. You can sometimes have this and associate it with a fracture. So the dislocation got reduced, but you need to want to find out what the x-ray actually shows to make sure there's not a small fracture, in addition to which trying to prevent it from recurring again, whether splinting is going to be indicated.
Sure. So we're glad that he got better. Glad the x-ray tech did the reduction for you and hope that he's all better and doesn't require anything else.
Also shows that traction on injured joints is usually a good thing.
Mm-hmm.
What do we have last, Julie?
I've been experiencing symptoms for about a week of blurry vision, nervousness, migraines, fatigue, rapid breathing, dizziness, and chronic pain all over my body. I'm not sure what's going on, but I know my body and it doesn't feel right. Should I be concerned or is it just stress?
Wow. That's a really big question and one that I'm sure we can't do justice on the air in this brief time. But I would say that the fact that you are concerned enough to share it with us and that you're having all these different symptoms means that, yeah, you should talk to a doctor about those things.
Well, yeah. And I think, you know, you said, should I be concerned or is it just stress? The answer is yes and yes. You should be concerned even if it's stress because – that amount of symptoms would suggest to me that there's a lot of stress going on to produce that amount of symptoms, and that's very worrisome. I mean, I think there's a false assumption sometimes, Christy, that people think, oh, it's just stress. Like that makes it better. And the reality is stress can be, you know, we know there's lots of diseases, including cardiac conditions, that stress can precipitate bad things. And for you, I don't know if it's stress or not, but, you know, blurred vision, nervousness, migraines, fatigue,
dizziness.
Difficulty breathing, dizziness, pain. Wow. There's lots of things that could also be going on that are not stress-related but maybe mimicking stress.
I would agree with all of that, Adam. So, I mean, I would take this seriously. I would be concerned whether it's stress or not, and I would make that visit to a doctor and really talk about what's going on.
And this time of year, the doctors will almost always ask you about, for instance, tick exposure. You know, we're still at the season where tick exposure and some of your symptoms could suggest that maybe you have a Lyme disease early or some other tick exposure, as well as just all kinds of other, just even viruses in general could cause a lot of your symptoms.
Sure. So hopefully you've already talked with a doctor about it, and we want you to do that, and we hope that you're feeling better very, very soon.
Well, we should thank you for sending in your house calls today. We've had a chance to talk about stress and the fact that even if it's there, it needs to be treated, but don't assume that's the cause of the disease.
We've talked a little bit about nursemaid's elbow.
And that it's not child abuse.
And we've talked a little bit about the flu vaccine, which hopefully there'll just be one this year, and you should get one.
And if you want to really extend your medications longer, get more medicines. Don't just cut them in half. Make sure that you're taking what your doctor prescribed. Well, that's going to conclude the House Call segment of our show today, and we want to thank you for joining us on your health. We hope we've addressed things that are important to you, and you'll share your own questions and experiences. Email us at yourhealth@unc.edu or call us at 919-966-8081.
And you can also visit us online at yourhealthradio.org. And you can also follow us on Twitter by going to twitter.com and searching for Your Health Radio. We want to thank the staff of WCHL and the UNC Department of Family Medicine, UNC Healthcare for their sponsorship, our producer Julie Steiner, and our guest today, Dr. Linda Van Lee. We hope you'll join us next time on Your Health.
On behalf of UNC Department of Family Medicine, I'm Dr. Adam Goldstein.
And I'm Dr. Christy Page.
And we look forward to talking to you again next week.
The purpose of Your Health Radio is to educate listeners on healthcare issues. Listeners should always discuss their own health or medical concerns with their personal physician or other healthcare provider. Your health is not a substitute for medical advice, diagnosis, or treatment.
Your Health with Dr. Adam Goldstein and Dr. Christy Page has been brought to you by UNC Family Medicine for the Chapel Hill Carborough community. You can hear Your Health on Saturdays at 9 a.m., Sundays at 9 and 5, and Mondays at 6 and 10 p.m. You can also go to our website, 1360WCHL.com, and click on WCHL On Demand. Your Health with Dr. Adam Goldstein and Dr. Christy Page, a presentation of UNC Family Medicine and News Talk 1360 WCHL.